So yesterday we discussed the rebel who is refuses to be oppressed by the status quo, and we looked into what keeps us from seeing, from waking up and realizing our true, who we truly are. Right, something like that. You know, it's kind of like at the beginning in series, you know, at the beginning in previous episodes. So that's just a very brief synopsis of in the previous episode yesterday. Actually, the in previous episodes every day could be the same, because basically I talk about the same thing every day. However, it's different every time. Like we said, it's different circumstances, different people, different situation, different time, place, whatever. So in our tradition, this morning I mentioned the practice of koans, which many of you are familiar with, some not. So in our tradition, koans are, the Zen tradition in general is something of a shortcut. If we compare it with other schools of Buddhism, and again, as many of you know, I'm not even sure that I consider Zen a school of Buddhism, but technically it is. I don't necessarily consider myself a Buddhist, but I am a Zen practitioner, and I know other Zen practitioners who are rabbis, priests, no religious affinity whatsoever. So just I'll say that little parenthesis. In any case, in the other Buddhist schools and traditions, they all have their practices, their rituals, their techniques, and their elaborations, and their way of explaining, and there's all of it comes from the sutras, which were actually not compiled until several hundred years after the Buddha died. He never actually wrote anything, the Buddha, so anything that is written did not come from him, his hand. So we have all of these things. The Zen tradition says, it's not about any of that stuff. The founder of Bodhidharma said, it's outside the sutras. It's outside of all of that. As Bart reminded me yesterday when we were walking in the march, D.T. Suzuki, one of the key people who brought the Zen, made Zen more popular in the West with all of his study and writing, said that the term kinhin, which is this walking meditation we do, actually means sutras walking. And as Bart said yesterday, this is really an experience of sutras walking. We were sutras walking in the street yesterday. We're sutras walking around here. This is the Zen approach. You are the sutra. So that's why we say it's outside of the sutras, the sacred texts, nothing sacred, nothing holy, or everything holy, everything sacred. So here we are, these sutras walking. What does that mean then? What does that mean with all of these sutras and all of these sayings and all of these stories? What does it mean about, do we not pay any attention to that then? Are we saying that it's not true? And this is one of the dichotomies that we hold in the Zen school. We're constantly talking about the Buddha, quoting the Buddha, people ask, what is Buddha? And then, you know, people give responses like anything from, you know, the oak tree in the garden to a shit stick to mind, to no mind, all of these different responses that are given for what is Buddha in the Zen tradition. And yet we refer to Buddha. We chant these things, you know, we have the chant we have before, we have the Oriyoki chant, when we refer to all of these bodhisattvas, you know, Vajrasattva, Vairochana, Sambhogakaya, all of these things. And yet we don't pay much attention, we don't study these sutras so much. We have ceremonies, services, where we might recite them. The Heart Sutra especially. And yet, the founder of our tradition, Bodhidharma, said, this is all outside the sutras. So in our tradition, in the Zen tradition, especially in my branch of the Zen tradition, we work with koans, as I mentioned this morning, as a means to open a view of the absolute, of what is not dualistic, of what is not conceptual, to go beyond, let's say, our yes, no, good, bad, big, small, here, there, you, me, to go beyond that. This is like a tool, these koans are tools for that. And if we can keep that in mind when we're working on koans, that's a very important instruction. It's about seeing the absolute. It's about experiencing and awakening to the absolute. Sometimes we get all caught up in the story and what does this mean and that, and I don't really see the point, and it's obvious, and we lose sight of what the point is to awaken, to open to the absolute. Which means, it's another way of saying, to see our true nature, to see the true nature of all things, which is beyond space and time, beyond big and small, beyond here and there, beyond me and you, as I said. The true nature of things is that. And these are all just words I'm putting on it. But we have to have some kind of, this is how we communicate in this relative world where there is big and small, there is a clock, there is this room and there's the outside, there is this side of the river and that side of the river. You know, one of the Zen jokes is, you know, there's two guys, one on each side of the river, and one is saying, you know, hey, help me, I want to come across. And the one who he's shouting to says, you're already there. So, you know, it's true from the absolute point of view. On the other hand, if this guy is hungry and there's food on this side and there isn't on that side, well, help him get across so he can eat. That's the compassionate view, we say. The wisdom view is you're already there. There aren't two sides. The compassionate view, though, is somebody's hungry. And there's food on this side, and there's not on that side. So we welcome them, knowing full well that there's not two sides. And because we know there aren't two sides, we can welcome the person who's hungry with open arms. If we were stuck on the fact that there's not two sides, or if we were stuck on the fact that there are two sides and we don't want him to eat my food, then we have problems, right? As we were saying yesterday. So one of the great koans we have related to this, a great koan, let's say, it's a beautiful koan, a difficult koan, a challenging koan, that actually is not, but because we don't see it, it seems challenging. It's very brief. It's from the Mumen Khan, which is a classic collection of koans. And it's the fourth case. I think there are, anybody know how many cases there are in the Mumen Khan? 48 maybe? 48, yeah. So this is case four in the Mumenkan, and it is called The Barbarian Has No Beard. Already, this is, there's a barbarian. We talked about this yesterday. So this is the koan. Wakwan, who was a master, we don't really know much about this Zen master, but asked, why has the Western barbarian no beard? That's the koan. So, what are they talking about here? Why is he asking this question? Who's the Western barbarian? Why do we care if the guy has a beard or not, right? And this is how our discursive thinking mind goes. Wonderful. That's where we need to go there. We need to get through all of that. We need to exhaust that mind. As I said yesterday, you know, why is a really great key to open things. Isn't that what I said? Something like that yesterday? Well, yeah, whatever. So, the Western barbarian for Chinese, these collections were made, most of these koans came from the golden age of Zen, which was the 9th century in China. At that time, everyone in the Zen world would have known who they were talking about when they said the Western barbarian. So it's important to have this little bit of knowledge, although from the absolute point of view, it doesn't matter who we're actually talking about, but from the relative point of view, it is. So the Western barbarian is Bodhidharma. He came from the West, meaning for the Chinese, he came from India, came to China in the 5th century, I think it was, something like that. And for the Chinese, anybody with a barb in French, anyone with a beard was a barbarian. The Chinese did not have beards, and they thought these were, you know, scuzzy, uncouth heathens, barbarians who had beards. And Bodhidharma, in all the images we have of him, he's got this enormous beard, this straggly beard. And there is no possibility of Bodhidharma without a beard in any of the images we see of him. So, this Zen master is asking, why has the Western barbarian no beard? So how can it be that everything we know about Bodhidharma says he has a beard, and this guy is saying he doesn't have one, and he's asking you why? This is a challenging question, right? The mysteries of Zen practice, you know? We're always presented with these contradictions, which is actually the mystery of life, this innumerable contradictions, you know? Contradiction, how can we be born just to die? You know, that's a big one. It's like, well, why even bother, you know? You know, how can I be older than someone and younger than someone else? Or how can I be, how can I be both French and American, you know? We can find explanations for all of this. And yet, none of it has anything to do with the absolute true nature of things. Okay? But, as I said, we have to go there. We have to go and look into, okay, so why, how can it be that he has no beard when everybody's saying he does? I'm just looking at my notes to see if there's anything pertinent that might apply, but no. So, we are thrown into this thing, and if we're lucky, although You know, it's kind of like the good news and the bad news. If we're lucky, we will be caught by this thing, like a fish on a hook. And we won't let it go until we get to the bottom of it, if we're lucky. But on the other hand, it's really frustrating. Can be really, really challenging to be caught by this thing and you don't understand it. I mean, I tell the story of being caught on a koan, which I had no business working on, because I was not there in my practice, but my teacher had given a talk about it. It was this koan that's called The Last Word of Zen. Okay, so there's this story, and at one point the question is, well, what is the last word of Zen? So like this, my teacher gives a talk about this koan, and I just was obsessed, I became obsessed with it. I have kind of an obsessional personality, so koan practice was perfect for me. But and so I became obsessed with this koan during the retreat. And I was convinced, you know, I had enough experience, whatever, I was convinced that the last word of Zen is just this, right? So I would go into the interview, and I would say, the last word of Zen is this. She'd take the bell, ding, 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 ding. And then I would come in and I would say, it's just this. Ding, 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 ding. It's just this. Ding, 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 ding. And then I would like hit the floor and I'd say, it's just this. She'd be like, ding, 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 ding. And I was going crazy. And I think this went on like for 10 days. This was like a month-long retreat, you know. And I happened to be her assistant, her Jisha, and so every time I could, I squeezed myself into the Dokusan line and was like, it's just this. And eventually I was to the point where I said to her, and this, I'm like deep shame and embarrassment to even admit it, and it wasn't really true, but I said, I will give you my two children if you will tell me the answer. To show my desperation, right? Total desperation. And ding, 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 ding. I don't want your kids. So in the end, you know, I'm eternally grateful for her for that experience. For not allowing anything, not allowing me to get away with anything, you know. No concepts, no ideas, no fixed positions, no having, you know, it would have been tragic had she told me, because that would not be it. Whatever she tells me would not be it, because you have to realize it yourself. Same with this, you know, so you might become just obsessed with it and say, well, he doesn't have a beard because he shaved, or, you know, something, I don't, you know, whatever. And you come up with this stuff that your head is telling you, and yet, ding, 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 ding. And this is a very compassionate ding, 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 ding. This is full of compassion. It's not to, you know, enhance your frustration or to, you know, make you suffer or anything. It really comes from compassion, so that you can realize for yourself what it is, why the Western barbarian has no beard. And so you have to go through all of this. Okay, so who's the Western barbarian? We just said it's Bodhidharma, but who's Bodhidharma? What did Bodhidharma tell us? You know, what was his message? Where is Bodhidharma? What is a beard? What is it to have a beard and not have a beard? We really have to look, you know, really look at it from all these different angles. It's like, you know, if you had a, you know, it's kind of metaphorically like having a 3D image floating in space, and you can see it like through, from all the perspectives. Because we tend to be fixed on our one perspective. And we go back in over and over, just this, just this, just this, just this. And, you know, sometimes it's like we are really stuck on it, really stuck. which actually, like I said, is a wonderful experience. Sometimes when I'm, because I have this obsessional personality, you know, I don't even choose to, but for example, when the crisis with refugees flooding into Europe from Syria, Afghanistan, and elsewhere started happening, you know, probably 8 or 10 years ago, I became obsessed with that like a koan, because it made no sense. For me, it was like this Bodhidharma has no beard koan. So these people have to leave their homes, they're forced to flee because of war, of terrorism, of oppression, of persecution. They are forced to flee their countries, their homes, where they've generations they've lived. And they go through these unbelievable, terrible experiences of getting wherever they're trying to get. They arrive in Europe, and they die, many perished en route and are still perishing. And they would get here and at the gates of Europe, and we would tell them, no, you can't come here. You can't have our food. You can't live on our land. You can't benefit from our economic systems and our healthcare systems and education systems. No. This was a koan for me. Of course, I understood it perfectly from a logical point of view, from a rational, political, social, economic point of view. I understood it. I knew exactly why people were saying you can't come. But I didn't understand, it just became this koan for me. So as I know with koan study, you have to become whatever it is. You have to go there. You have to plunge into whatever it is you don't understand. So in this, you know, koan, it's like, you become Bodhidharma, you become beard, you become Western barbarian. You just become it. To transcend the whole dichotomy of good and bad, beard and no beard, me and you, him and me, and barbarian, not barbarian, all of that. So what I chose to do with the refugees was to go work or volunteer at, and it so happens that I had just lost my job, so I had lots of time, and I would go volunteer at this center, a day short-term living center for refugees in Paris. And I've told many times, basically, I just did their laundry. There were different jobs that we were assigned to, and mine was often to do laundry. So they would bring the few possessions they had. We would put it in a laundry basket, give them, you know, a number, wash and dry their laundry, fold it, and they would come back a few hours later and get their laundry. They could also charge their phones, have tea and coffee, hang out. It was cold, you know, in the winter, hang out there. Some of them were admitted to stay there for short term while they were waiting for their papers to be processed. And I spent a lot of time there. And I spent a lot of time with these guys. It was men only. There was another center for families and women. Only men here. You know, all of these men were about the age of my son, who at the time was, you know, 23 or something, 24. And, no, even younger than that. Yeah, he was 20, yeah. And they were all like him. They dressed like him. They had phones like his. They listened to the same music he was listening to. They, when there was a football match on, they all watched the same football matches that everybody else in Europe was watching. Champions League, whatever it was. Most of them had college educations. Most of them spoke quite good English. Not many spoke French. Some spoke German because they had first gone through Germany in transit camps, and in Germany, the first thing they did was teach people German while they were there. In France, they were a little bit slow with that, but they started doing it quite soon after. So some of these guys, you know, they could speak German, having only spent 2 months or something in a German refugee camp. And I guess maybe they weren't allowed to stay. There were quotas in Germany that were quite big. This was under Merkel, and, you know, they allowed a lot of people to stay. But if, you know, the quotas for Afghans had been met, then they had to go on somewhere else. I went there so that I could become one with whatever it is. So it's not that I became a 20-year-old Afghan refugee, but I experienced what we shared. I experienced our nature. I experienced the essence of who we are. Saw the difference, right? That guy had a beard and I don't. Just stay with the beard thing. Yet, where we meet, there's no beard, or having a beard or not having a beard, right? I taught them meditation when I could. Didn't happen very often, but I did. Because the people who ran the place asked me to do it. Washing someone's clothing is a really powerful experience, actually, really deeply moving experience to see. These are all the possessions this guy has in the world, except for what he was wearing, because he didn't stand around naked. But, and to, you know, to do it carefully and fold it and not lose it, not mix up one guy's clothing with another guy's, to really see that, so they have different clothing, and yet we're all one. So how do we, my training in koan practice, makes that possible for me to better connect with what we share instead of focusing on our differences. And if we look at this koan, so if we can say the entire universe is Bodhidharma, because if we start looking into, okay, so what if we start eliminating what separates us, eventually we become everything. We become everyone. We see that not in form, but in essence. And we can see even more clearly the difference, that we can appreciate more clearly the differences in form and in presentation and in manifestation. And we know that the sound of the train going by is not the same as the ambulance. Or we can clearly distinguish that, right? We can clearly distinguish someone who is 4 years old and someone who is 14. No problem. It's much more difficult for us to see what is shared, what is, let's see, I hate to use these words like beyond or behind or under, because it's not under, it's not beyond, it's here and now. So when we say, why has the Western barbarian no beard, we're asking you to go beyond the differences while all the while appreciating them, which is the hardest part, you know. The teacher of my teacher's teacher, so Maizumi Roshi, who brought this, my lineage to the West, always said, as many Zen masters say, that glimpsing the absolute, you know, that's not difficult, actually. What is difficult is to embody that and to integrate the relative and the absolute together as one. Or as my teacher's teacher, Genpo Roshi, he had this whole technique that he used to teach with called Big Mind, and he used to use the example of a triangle. And so on one side would be the absolute, one side would be the relative, and at the top would be what he called the apex. I mean, in a triangle, that's the apex, but. And that apex is, you see that they both meet there. The thing with the problem with the triangle image is that it makes it seem like it's above. Yeah, Genpo would say that that's not what he means, but we can easily see that as being above. But it's not above. You are the apex. You are where the relative and the absolute function all the time. Meet, function, manifest all the time. You are always manifesting your timeless, impermanent, pure nature, true self, also manifesting, you know, whatever age you are, whatever, wherever you came from, whatever job you do, whatever color socks you're wearing, whatever your job was before you came here, who your parents are, all of that. You're manifesting all of that at once. It's not separate. This koan is pushing us there. So why has the Western barbarian no beard? How can we, let me see if I had any. You know, if we only see the absolute point of view, there is no compassion, there is no love, there is no hate, there is no joy, there is no sorrow. If we only see the relative point of view, love, hate, joy, sorrow, beard, no beard, if we only see that, we then become attached to our preferences, wanting things to be a different way, judging, fixing on a viewpoint, and we miss then the whole universe. We only see parts of it, the parts that we like, the parts that we want, the parts that we hang on to, whatever. At the same time, you know, if we say, okay, we see the differences, you know, there's this kind of, how could I say it? I often say this is totalitarianism, when we say, we want everything to be the same. It's to see the absolute, but without seeing the differences, and judging the differences. And that leads to totalitarianism, where we want everyone to be the same. So whatever is not does not correspond to that, we will eliminate. So the West, the barbarians, we will eliminate them. And an absolute, if we want to become stuck in an absolute point of view, there is a risk of that kind of totalitarianism where we say, oh, everything's okay. You know, it's okay. It's okay to kill people. There's nobody to kill. It's like with the guy on the other side of the river. There aren't two sides of the river. You're already there. Get your own food. Or there's nobody who's hungry. Don't come and work on my land. Don't come and live in my city. Don't come and live in my streets, because usually that's where the people were living, in the streets. So what do we do with this? Why has the Western barbarian no beard? So if we say, okay, from the view of wisdom, we would say there is no beard. There is, from the equality point of view, we would say everything is different, but everything is equal, something like that, you know. No beard, no not beard, so we transcend the differences. But we also need to see the differences, is what I'm trying to say. We also, because if we don't, then it's dangerous, like with the two sides of the river. So what do we do, you know? And I can't really tell you because that would be a crime. And you wouldn't even understand unless you experience it for yourself. You can't really understand. So, you know, the most I can say is, as I said, you know, the whole universe is the beard and the whole universe is the no beard. But what does that mean? We in our study group, we had this great, I got some notes from another teacher in my lineage who I studied with, Bernie Glassman, some of his koan notes. He was the first successor of Maizumi Roshi. And some of his koan notes that we used in our study group once about a koan, there's a stone at the bottom of the river. How do you pick it up without getting wet, I think, or something like that. And then they go through the Bernie's notes where he wrote down after his dokusans with his teacher. He wrote down step by step how they went through it. And it's, for me as a teacher, it's a wonderful tool to see how brilliant Maizumi Roshi was working with his students. But he goes through, you know, so the stone and the water are separate. The stone and the water are not separate. The stone is wet. The stone is dry. The stone is not dry. The stone is not wet. And it goes through all of this, which is a really good example of how do we hold the two, stone, me, stone, water, wet, not wet. How do we hold all of that? It's actually not, as we say in English, rocket science. It's not really complicated. It seems complicated from this dualistic mind that we are so enamored with and so familiar with. But actually, when in our functioning every day in our life, we are manifesting it all the time. We're doing it all the time, but we don't think about it. We're not aware of it. Not that we don't think about it. We're not aware of it. You know, it's something like when we walk, you know, we're constantly unbalanced, and yet we're perfectly in balance. Riding a bicycle, you know, we have to find this equilibrium. Driving a car, constantly manifesting being alive and dying, because every moment we're dying, and yet every moment we're alive. We're being born and dying at every moment. You know, scientifically, it's, I forget how many millions of cells die per minute in order for us to live, because they regenerate. Then they are born again. You know, this whole thing about, I guess maybe I shouldn't, you know, it's blasphemy to mention Christ's resurrection here, but, you know, this resurrection is really just a possibility, let's say, of interpreting that Christian doctrine of Christ resurrecting, is that his disciples, Christ resurrects in them. They awaken. It's like we awaken to the Buddha in us, who we truly are. That's the resurrection of Christ for me, let's say, and others that I know of. That the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, if you will, or the Spirit of Jesus is resurrected in you. You are that. You are the way. I mean, Jesus, he said that. And he paid dearly for it. So every moment we have this contradiction of being born and dying. We could say it's a contradiction to be a daughter and a mother. We could say it's a contradiction to be a sister and a wife. or whatever, you know, any kind of labels you want to attach, apparent contradictions. And yet we fluidly function with these most of the time. Sometimes we're really caught by them. Sometimes, you know, we feel like, I can't be this and that. I know my daughter, who's a young mother, it's really hard for her to go to work and not be with her young son. And she feels like she's not good at work and she's not good at home. She will have to integrate this. She will have to become all of it, to become one with all of it. And we do it. In our practice, we're asking us to, on a very essential, fundamental level, realize that. Realize the very essence of being. Because once we do that, then all of these other apparent dichotomies are not a problem, because they're not dichotomies. We see they are different, but they don't contradict one another, and it's not a problem to function within them. Or among them, let's say, because we are them as well, you know? Trying to think of other contradictions that I'm sure we can all think of many examples. So, any comments, questions? Koan is perfectly clear. Everybody knows what to present it, and everyone will come to Koan Dokusan tonight and say, "My Koan is why does the Western barbarian have no beard?" And I'm kidding. It's possible. Everything that's absolutely possible. I have absolute faith in every one of you. So, no doubt.
I practiced having a beard, not having a beard, literally. It was quite an interesting practice to have a beard for a while, because everybody was having an opinion about it. Thinking about, oh, that's good, that's nice. I knew that was going to happen, so I said to myself, well, let it just go, let's see where this is heading to. And it was really, really wonderful to have this experience of having a beard. And then again to hear the voices of my wife, for example, who didn't like the beard, to just let it be and have a fight even about the beard. Then left that as well, and then I got myself, I had enough of the beard, so it went away. And then again it came up, everybody had an opinion about it. Even I know my father, he had a strong opinion about having people having beards.
That they should have beards?
That students should not have it.
Oh.
So even that dichotomy of beard, no beard was interesting to work with, to see what's happening to me, what I'm thinking about it. It's
Were you doing this while you were working on this koan?
No. Later on, I read this, I was reading, going through the Mumonka, and I read exactly this koan few weeks ago, and then I was working on it, like a little bit, like you said. And it's a really good column. Yeah.
I have a question about
column. Yeah.
The answer is not always the same, but it seems like the answer is always the same for all columns. But no, you said that we must experience the answer. Because it's not a mental thing.
That's right.
You must experience the answer. But the answer is not the absolute, because the absolute must be equal for every. I don't know if you understand.
Well, the absolute is a concept.
It's a concept too. But what you feel in the answer, it's different for all the for different.
Oh concepts. Yeah, because it's a specific circumstance. It's a specific situation, question, poem, something. It's always different. That's why there are so many of them. There's like, you know, in our curriculum, there's 750. Other schools have shorter, longer.
So the result for us, it's, for everyone, is different. It's a little step further in the wisdom.
Let's say a different experience.
It's a different experience.
Yeah.
Each one is a different, okay.
Yeah. Not necessarily a progression or a step further,
yes, okay.
But a different experience, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And each one has its own answer, or is it the process is the way? Like, can you ask someone to go on and they go, oh, I got it. And then say, oh, yeah, that's it.
It could be.
It could be.
Mm.
Okay.
Could be. The process is the way, though, yes, always, yeah. However, it's very difficult to, when you're involved in it, it's very difficult to just give in to the process is the way, because you really want to get to the end of the process, you know. And so I always say to people, all the stuff you're going through is, you know, this is what it's about, and this is what this is it. And then after, you know, after they've worked through it, and I said okay, and I didn't ring the bell, then they can appreciate everything. Like I can appreciate all that stuff I went through with that koan. So yeah.
I think that this koan is perhaps more difficult for women. This would be a contradiction, because my story with the beer was different. Actually, I shave every day because I don't like to have beard. Somehow I got it, this experience of shaving every day, when a long time ago I went to the army, which was some experience I didn't want to have it at all. I was pacifist at the time, I was completely against the army, but that was compulsory. And I remember that, yeah, many days I just let the shave the other day or something like that. In the army we could not do it. We really had to shave sometimes twice a day. And somehow I got this habit of shaving every day in the army, a place that in fact I didn't like to be. And it has been all my life since I was in the army. So I do need to shave because I got this experience in a side of a place in my life that I really didn't want to be. That is something that maybe is approaching these contradictions, these codes that you are mentioning again, is out of my male experience. So that's why I say maybe it's a little bit harder for women not to. No, I'm speculating, of course, because I know the code has nothing to do with that, has nothing to do with sex or gender or whatever. But when we were talking about that, listening to Bart, and I said, well, I have these experience in my life, which is in a way very fun. So I don't wear a beard because I need to shave every day out of this beautiful experience of being in a place where I learned, where I had to really shave, and I didn't like that at all.
You know, you probably know the answer that's coming, that it might be more difficult for men because of that. But it might have the same problem for women, because women don't want a beard, right? I don't know any women who want a beard, right?
And like all women, like most women have facial hair that they grow up like hating, and like all
right.
The diseases that like I've been through, like I've
get
tried,
rid of it,
like,
yeah.
Like when you don't see it, then my boyfriend is always like, oh, you have a huge hair. It's already too, like he counts the centimeters. Oh, it's 1 centimeter, it's 2 centimeters. Oh no, now another one is growing. Oh, was that because you plucked the first one out? What's happening? So like women also have beards.
And actually it has nothing to do with either side that we're talking about, actually, you know. But it does, so that's why these are really personal koans, because they do appeal to what our experience is and the process we go through. Someone might not have any problem with this koan. You know, I work with people on all kinds of koans, and some koans that I had a really hard time with myself when I was doing it, somebody just, no problem. You know, the thing of the last word of Zen. I haven't really worked with anyone else who had as much trouble as I had on that. Or other koans that were just really crystal clear for me, people like, they don't get it, and they don't get it, and they don't get it. And I have to meet them where they are, you know. I can't expect them to have my experience, they have their experience, and I have to accompany them there. So each of us will have different experiences with it. There's that the story that we tell sometimes in relation to this of, it's in Tintin, you know, Tintin, the comic books, of the Captain Haddock, who has a beard, a big beard. Yeah, big beard. And I can't remember which book it's in, I don't know. But he, so someone asks him if he sleeps with his beard on top of the blanket or under the blanket. He doesn't know. Never thought of it. And so when he goes to bed that night, there's drawings of him like, he puts it on top and then he's, no. Puts it underneath, no. And he can't sleep. Because he doesn't know if it's on top or on the bottom. He just functioned freely before this was all put into doubt, you know? He probably didn't even think of himself as having a beard, unless he was really associated with having a beard, like, you know, and everybody was sending messages to him, beard, 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 you know. Or no beard, no beard, no beard, or no beard, no beard, no beard. I don't think there's a rule for men and women, you know, in relation to this koan. And the thing is, we don't really know much about this teacher who is quoted as saying it, Wakwan said, and we don't really know much about him or in what context he did this, and yet it absolutely doesn't matter. Again, you know, we might, like, what people do now. When I was working on koans, we didn't have the internet, but what people do now is they Google it. Check it out, see what was said about it, see where it came from, who's Wakwan. Teachers, you know, there's talks online about it, and or, you know, there might be some, like, Western Barbarian. Usually I tell people when they're working on this koan, the Western Barbarian is Bodhidharma. And then they'll look up Bodhidharma and see what they say about Bodhidharma and what this teacher said about the koan and that teacher. And I always say, you know, it's really a shame because it's just going to make it harder, you know. The more you read about it, the more concepts you fill your head with, the harder it is to come to your heart, to come to your experience of it, because you're looking for someone else's experience. You're looking to have that to understand what somebody else said. So even what I'm saying about it, it might help, it might clarify some things, but it's not your experience, you know?
Have you tried to compare to the ChatGPT?
Yeah. That, you know, that is the limitation of, I do that in writing workshops too. I have people that don't have anything to do with Zen, but we do like a session on, you know, so artificial intelligence, and so what is it that artificial intelligence can't write? You know, these are creative writing workshops. So what, it can write a lot of things, and it can do really amazing things and write an outline for a dissertation and, you know, all kinds of really good stuff, but in a creative writing workshop, we go into, so what can't it write? You know, and this is an example. It can't write your experience. Mm-hmm. It can't give you the answer to you, your experience. It can't. It just can't. It might be helpful for writing a paper about who is Bodhidharma, probably very helpful, you know, or the origins of this koan, or, right, you know, different versions of what people have said about it, but no.
That reminded me, I sat in Japan once in a place that allowed Westerners, and I walked in and they didn't say a word to me, they just pointed me to the cushion, they didn't show me how to sit, they didn't tell me anything, and then one guy came up to me and whispered "move" in my ear.
That's right. Yep. That is still, you know, kind of the Zen way is we've tried to become a little more kind in the West, so we give people instructions.
Yeah.
Although the first retreat I went to, just for 2 days with my teacher, nobody told me anything. In fact, I showed up and everyone was wearing black robes and I was in shorts and a t-shirt. Nobody had said, you know, you shouldn't dress that way or anything. And then they invited us, you know, so then it was time to go into the Zendo. I was delighted because my dream was to sit with people. I had just been sitting on my own, you know. And we go in there and someone had said to me, actually Michel Dubois had said to me, you know, Amy, I have a pair of sweatpants you might want to wear, you know, like some black sweatpants. And I was like, no, I'm fine, you know. But it was hot. I'm fine. He was trying to help me by saying, you know, maybe you shouldn't wear those shorts in there. But nobody said anything. Sat. They rang a bell. And then everybody stood up and starts, like, doing kin-in. I didn't know what was going on. So I just followed. And I had heard about kin-in, and I heard you walk slow, and somebody had showed me kind of how to do it, but never in a group. And so about halfway through, one of the monks pulled me out of the Zendo, and he said, have you ever done kin-in before? I said, no, not in a group anyway. And he said, well, because everybody was waiting behind you. I was walking really slowly. Nobody told me, you know. I probably would have figured it out eventually, kind of like you, although I don't know if you figured out Mu, but I probably would have figured it out eventually. It was a good experience. It was a good experience to not have any instructions, and it was a good experience to know how that felt, and then it was a good experience to have some instructions. So both are, it's up to the teacher to know what's the right amount. That's what our Oryoki practice about, is the right amount. We say that if, you know, if a Zen teacher talks too much, says too much, their eyebrows will fall out. So it's some, I don't know, I forget, you know, some folklore thing in Chinese, but so, you know, I try to be wary. I don't want to lose my eyebrows. What's too much? What is telling too much? I feel it. I know when. It's just become clear to me what is appropriate and what's not. But I trust that you all will learn to trust your experience, and so that whatever someone else is saying is the answer, you won't accept. However, it can be difficult if we filled our heads with a lot of answers. And apparently there are even books nowadays where they have answers to the koans written. which is completely absurd because you can't put it in a book, you know? It's
you can, I mean, we won't do anything.
Right, that's right.
Maybe Hindi.
I was telling Rory about seeing an edition of the New York Review of Books, great publishing company, published the book Dawns, and I was really excited to see it. And I opened the first page and I see the koan and then answer, and I was like, oh my.
I had a similar experience. My friend who introduced me to them years ago had a book called The Book of Moon, and it's like this thick. And I thought, burn it. I don't want to see it again, ever. I never want to see that book.
Because what was it?
I have no idea. I didn't even dare to look at it. I saw the title. I was like, no, not The Book of Moon. I don't want to hear loads of talk about Moon. I mean, it was terrible.
Yeah.
Keep
that thing away from you. Yeah. So see, this is this is an interesting reflex we have of, and it's kind of mixed because it's like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
At the same time, no, we know that that's not what we want. And so just to come back very briefly because we have to end soon, this is why a koan practice involves working with the teacher. Working with someone who has gone through the process themselves, and you can't solve the koan, you can't move on with koans unless you have an interaction with a teacher, because it's a living, alive process. And if, you know, you can do a lot of things on your own in your practice, but we need that interaction in the koan practice, because it's alive. So I needed my teacher to ring the bell and say no. Otherwise, I would have gone on. She saved me many times when I would have just gone on with a concept or hanging on to some beautiful experience I had and becoming the prophet of bliss, like I dreamed of, you know, traveling the world and telling everybody my Dharma name. You are that. Every time they ask me, hello, what's your name? You are that. crazy. So we need the teacher to ding, ding, ding. Any last comment or question? Because I think we do have to break for lunch. Okay. Let's do the four vows.